biological parent who might never arrive. "Well, it's off to work for me," Ellie said. "Bye, Alice." Alice hugged Ellie. "Bye, Lily." Ellie hugged her back. "Cal said it's a half day today at the girls' school. He'll bring Sarah by for a while after lunch." "Tell him thanks. Maybe Alice will talk to Sarah this time." She nuzzled Alice's neck. "Right, little girl?" Alice's answer was a high-pitched giggle. Ellie left the house and went out to her cruiser. With a quick honk, Alice loved that noise, she was off. In the weeks since Christmas and New Year's, Rain Valley had settled back into its usual midwinter routine. More often than not, the downtown streets were empty of both cars and people. The taverns filled up earlier and stayed busy longer. Ellie and Earl and Mel took turns waiting just off the highway for drivers who thought it was okay to pound beers and then operate a vehicle. Weekend matinees at the theater were jammed to the rafters with kids, and it was impossible to get a lane or a parking stall at the bowling alley. News of the flying wolf girl had all but faded from the newspapers. Even Mort had better things to write about these days, like the rumblings at Mount St. Helens and the court-sanctioned Macaw tribe whale hunt. Days at the station slid back into their comforting routine. Calm had returned to Rain Valley, and those who were charged with keeping that peace were glad. Cal had more time again to read his comics and draw his drawings, since the phone rarely rang. Peanut scheduled everyone according to their family needs and paid their paychecks on time. In short, life was good. Now Ellie drove through the Ancient Grounds coffee stand, got a grande mocha latte, then continued on to the station. She pulled into her parking stall behind the station and went in the back door. She was in the lunchroom, checking out what was in the fridge, when Peanut bustled into the room and slammed the door shut behind her.
"Ellen," she said in the stage whisper she reserved for big gossip.
Ellie took a sip of her coffee and glanced at the clock. 11:30 was pretty early for big news. "Let me guess. The wrong person was voted off Survivor." Peanut smacked her. "Survivor's over." Ellie shut the fridge. "Okay. What's the skinny, big girl?"
"It's important that you keep your wits about you. Cal and I are worried."
"That I'm witless? How comforting."
"You know how stupid you get around certain men."
"I'm not admitting that. However, the only good-looking man in town is hot for my sister."
"Not anymore."
"Max isn't into jewels anymore?"
Peanut hit her in the shoulder. "Pay attention."
Ellie frowned. "What in the hell are you babbling about?"
"There's a guy waiting for you out front."
"So? Why the full panic?"
"He's gorgeous. And he won't talk to anyone but you."
"No kidding."
"You should see the way you're smiling. This is exactly what I was afraid of."
Ellie eased out of the lunchroom and peered down the hallway. From here, all she could see was a man, with his back to her, sitting in the chair opposite her desk. He was dressed all in black. "Who is it?"
"He wouldn't give his name. Won't take off his sunglasses either." She snorted. "Must be from California."
Ellie ducked back into the lunchroom and grabbed her purse. 5 minutes in the bathroom and she'd touched up her makeup and brushed her teeth. Back in the lunchroom, she turned to Peanut.
"How do I look?"
"This is so not good. You're going to go into full slut mode now."
"Fight me. I haven't had a date in months."
Ellie smoothed the wrinkles from her uniform, adjusted the 3 gold stars on her collar, and walked out into the main room of the station house. Peanut hurried along behind her. Cal looked up at her approach. He immediately noticed her makeup, then glanced at the man across from him and shook his head.
"Big surprise," he muttered. She kept moving.
"Hello, I'm Chief Barton," she said, rounding her desk. "I understand..."
He turned to her. Ellie forgot what she'd been about to say.
All she saw were chiseled cheekbones, full lips, and a mass of unruly black hair. He took off his sunglasses and revealed a pair of electric blue eyes.
"Holy Mother of God," she thought.
Ellie sat down without shaking his hand.
"I've come a long way to see you," he said in a worn, gravelly voice.
An accent, just a hint of one, but enough. She couldn't place it. Australian, maybe, or Cajun. She loved a man with an accent.
"I'm Georges Hazel."
He reached into his pocket and pulled out a folded piece of paper, which he set on her desk. The name registered.
"I see you remember me."
He leaned forward, pushing the paper closer to her.
"Don't worry about the way you're looking at me. I've grown used to it. I'm here about her."
"Her?" He unfolded the paper he'd pushed forward. It was a picture of Alice.
"I'm her father."
"Alice, how many times are we going to have this same discussion?" Julia couldn't help laughing at her own comment. She and Alice did many things together these days. None of them could accurately be characterized as a discussion. "Put your shoes on."
"No."
Julia went to the window and pointed outside. "It's raining." Alice collapsed to a sit on the floor.
"No."
"We're going to the diner. Remember the diner? We were there last week. Yummy pie." "Put your shoes on."
"No. Smelly shoes."
Julia threw up her hands in dramatic despair. "All right, then. You stay here with Jake and Elwood. I'll bring you home some pie." She went into the kitchen. With slow, exaggerated movements, she gathered her keys and purse, then put on her coat. She was halfway to the door when she heard Alice stand up.
"Girl, go?"
Julia didn't let herself smile as she turned around. Alice stood there, her little face scrunched in a scowl that was equal parts worry and anger. Her overalls were splattered with paint from their last art project. Julia meant to be firm, to say, "I'm sorry, you can't go without shoes, not to a restaurant," and pretend to go on her way while Alice hurriedly put on her shoes. That was what she would have done with an ordinary, stubborn child. Instead, Julia went to her and knelt down so that they were eye to eye. "Remember our talk about rules?"
"Good girl. Bad girl."
Julia winced at the characterization, but rules of behavior were a complex idea. They took years to process and understand. It was one of the hallmarks of socialization. Societies only existed in the presence of rules that governed people's behavior. "Some places make little girls wear shoes."
"Girl no like."
"I know, honey. How about this? No shoes in the car. You put them on in town and take them off when we leave. Okay?" Alice frowned in thought.
"No socks."
"Okay." Alice dutifully crossed the room and got her shoes out of the box by the front door. Without bothering with a coat, she went outside. As she stepped onto the porch, a cloud crossed the sky overhead, casting the yard in shadow. The drizzling rain turned to tiny flakes of snow. They kissed Alice's dark head and upturned face, immediately turning to droplets of freezing water.
"Look, Julie! Pretty!"
It was snowing, and Alice was barefooted. Perfect. Julia grabbed Alice's coat and scooped the girl into her arms, carrying her to the car. She was halfway there when she heard the phone ring.
"That's probably Aunt Ellie telling us to watch the snow."
She strapped Alice into the car seat.
"Icky! Tight! Bad!"
Alice said, running through her words for displeasure.
"Smelly!"
"It does not smell, and it keeps you safe." That shut Alice up. Julia put a CD in the player and drove away. Alice listened to the Pete's Dragon soundtrack 7 times without pausing. Her favorite song was Candle on the Water. Every time it ended, she cried out, "Again!" until Julia complied. Finally, they pulled into a spot in front of the raindrop and parked. The song snapped off.
"Again?"
"No, Alice, not now." Julia leaned sideways and tried to put Alice's clammy feet into her boots. It was like trying to put surgical gloves on wet hands. "Next time, I'm going to the mat for socks." She got out of the car and came around to Alice's side. Opening the door, she smiled. "You ready?" Fear flashed through Alice's eyes, but she nodded. "You're such a brave girl." Julia helped Alice out of the seat. Alice moved slowly toward the restaurant, staring down at her feet. "Don't be afraid, Alice. I'm right here. I won't let go." Alice clung so tightly it hurt, but didn't say a word. Julia opened the diner's door. A bell tinkled overhead. At the sound, Alice shrieked and threw herself at Julia. She bent down to hug the girl, held her tightly. The Grimm sisters were at the cash register, standing shoulder to shoulder. They'd obviously turned in unison at the noise, for now they were staring at Alice. Rosie Chakowski was behind them, tucking a pencil in her pink beehived hair. To the left, an old logger sat alone in a booth. Everyone was staring at Julia and Alice. They should have come an hour ago, between the breakfast and lunch crowds. That was what she'd done last week, and they'd had the place to themselves. Slowly, she stood back up. The Grimm sisters advanced, 3 abreast. Julia had a sudden thought about the Horsemen of the Apocalypse. These days, apparently, death rode in a battered urn in an old woman's arms. They stared at Julia, then at Alice. Julia stared back. Alice snorted nervously, tugged on Julia's hand. Violet reached into her purse and pulled out a bright purple plastic coin purse.
"Here you go. My granddaughter loves these."
Alice's eyes lit up at the gift. She touched it reverently, took it in her small hand, and stroked her cheek with it. After a moment, she blinked up at Violet and said,
"Uncle."
The 3 old women gasped and looked at one another. Finally, they looked at Julia.
"You saved her," Daisy said in a stiff voice, obviously bothered by the emotion behind the words.
"Your mom would be so proud," Violet said, nodding to her sisters for confirmation.
They bobbed their heads in unison. Julia smiled. For the first time in her life, she felt admired in this town, accepted. "Thank you. I couldn't have done it without all of you. The town really protected us."
"You're one of us," Daisy said simply.
As one, the trio turned and left the diner. Tightening her hold on Alice's hand, Julia led her to a booth in the corner. There they ordered grilled cheese sandwiches, fries, and milkshakes from Rosie. The food hadn't been served yet when the bell over the door tinkled again. Alice glanced up and said,
"Max,"
matter-of-factly. He didn't see them until he'd picked up his lunch order and turned for the door. When he looked at her, Julia's heart did a little flip.
"Hey,"
he said. She smiled up at him. "No date for lunch, doctor?"
"Not yet."
"Then perhaps you should join us." He looked down at Alice.
"May I sit next to you?"
Her little face scrunched in thought.
"No hurt, Julie?"
Max looked surprised by that.
"I wouldn't dream of it."
When he saw Alice's confusion, he said softly, "No hurt, Julia." Alice finally scooted sideways to make room for him. Max sat down across from Julia. He'd barely made contact with the vinyl seat when Rosie swooped in beside him. She was grinning from ear to ear.
It's like watching the moon landing. I knew it was true about you too.
She set out a place setting in front of him. Alice is my patient, Max said evenly. Rosie winked one heavily made-up false-lashed eye.
Course she is.
When she was gone, Max said, Before I finish my sandwich, everyone in town will know about this. Every patient I see for a week will ask about you. A few minutes later, Rosie showed up with their lunches.
Uncle,
Alice said, grinning up at the waitress. Rosie returned to the kitchen. Julia was about to tell Alice to eat one French fry at a time when she realized that Max was staring at her. She met his gaze and saw fear in his blue eyes. He was afraid of her, of them. It was a fear she understood. It had shaped much of her life. Passion was a dangerous thing, and love even more so. More often than not, it was love that had devastated her patients, either its excess or its lack. But Alice had taught her a thing or two about love and courage. What? He said, unsmiling. Julia felt something new, a kind of opening wonder. She wasn't afraid anymore. Come here, she said it softly. Frowning, he leaned toward her. She kissed him. For a heartbeat of time, he resisted. Then he gave in. Alice giggled.
Kisses!
When Max drew back, he was pale. Julia laughed. Might as well give the gossips something to talk about. After that, they went back to their lunches as if it hadn't happened. Later, as they stood at the front door putting their coats on, Julia dared to touch his arm. She'd already branded him publicly with her mouth. What was a touch on the arm after that? I'm taking Alice to the game farm in Squim. Would you like to join us? He paused just long enough to look at his watch, then said, I'll follow you. Julia bustled Alice out of the restaurant and back into the car. By the time they reached the entrance to the game farm, it was snowing in earnest. Big, fluffy white flakes fell from the sky. A few had begun to stick. A thin layer of white had formed on the fence line and on the grass. Julia pulled up to the small wooden house where the farm's owner lived. A pair of black bear cubs sat on the porch, chewing on huge sticks of wood. You need to put on your boots, your gloves, and your coat, Julia said.
No.
Stay in the car, then. Julia bundled up and got out of the car. She joined Max, who stood by his own car. Snow peppered them, landed like bits of fire on her nose and cheeks. What are we waiting for? He asked. You'll see. The car door opened. Alice climbed out. She was dressed for the weather, except that her boots were on the wrong feet. Just then, Floyd came out of the house, wearing a huge Arctic parka. Stepping past the playing bear cubs, he walked down the porch steps and across the snowy yard.
Hello, Dr. Cates. Dr. Saracen.
At Alice, he bent down.
And you must be Alice. I know a friend of yours.
Alice hid behind Julia.
It's okay, honey. This is your surprise.
Alice looked up.
Price?
Follow me, Floyd said.
They hadn't taken more than three steps when the howling started. Alice looked up at Julia, who nodded. Alice ran toward the sound. It was sad and soulful, that cry. It floated on the icy air. Alice answered in her own howl. They came together at the chain-link fence, the little girl in the black woolen coat and the oversized boots on the wrong feet, and the wolf that was now almost half its full-grown size. Floyd went to the gate. Alice was beside him in an instant, jumping up and down.
Open! Play! Girl!
He worked the lock. When it clicked, he turned to Julia.
Are you sure it's safe?
I'm sure. He eased the door open. Alice slipped into the pen. She and the wolf rolled around together, playing like littermates in the snow. Every time he licked her cheek, Alice giggled. Floyd shut the gate again. He stood there watching them play.
This is the first time he's stopped howling since I got him.
She missed him, too, Julia said.
What do you suppose?
I don't know, Floyd. They fell silent again, watching the girl and wolf roll around in the snow.
It's amazing what you've done with her, Max said to Julia.
She smiled. Kids are resilient.
Not always.
His answer was so quiet, she almost missed it. She was about to ask him what he meant, but before she'd formed the question, she heard sirens. Do you hear that? He nodded. The sound was far off at first, then it drew closer. Closer. When the first flashing lights appeared, cutting through the hazy snowfall, Floyd jumped into action. He grabbed Alice's coat and pulled her out of the pen, then slammed the gate shut. Alice dropped to her knees and howled miserably. The police cruiser drove into the yard and parked. The lights remained on, flashing in staccato bursts of color. Ellie walked toward them in the surreal light. "He's come for her," she said without preamble. "Who?" Julia asked. But when Ellie glanced at Alice, Julia knew. Alice's father. Max carried Alice into the house. She weighed almost nothing. He tried not to think about how natural this felt, carrying a child. But some memories were imprinted too deeply to ever erase, and some movements felt as natural as breathing. He tried to set her down on the sofa so he could build a fire. But she wouldn't free him, wouldn't uncoil her arms from around his neck. And all the while, as he carried her around the house and built the fire, she was howling in a quiet way that broke his heart. Finally, he sat down on the couch and drew her onto his lap. Her eyes were tightly shut. Her cheeks were still pink with cold. The sound she made, more whimper now than howl, was the physical embodiment of loss. Too much feeling and too few words. Look away, he told himself. Put on a movie or turn up the music. He leaned back and closed his eyes. He knew instantly it was a mistake. In his mind, he heard a child crying. Great big crocodile tears.
My fish isn't swimming anymore, Daddy. Make him all better.
Max tightened his hold on Alice.
It's okay, little one. Let it out. That's a good thing, actually.
At the sound of his voice, she drew in a sharp breath and looked up at him. It made him realize that it was the first time he'd spoken since they left the game farm.
Julia had to go to the police station with Ellie. They'll be back soon.
She blinked up at him through eyes that were surprisingly dry. He found himself wondering if she knew how to cry. The very idea of it, that she couldn't release her pain that way, wounded him.
No, Julie, leave, girl?
No, she'll be back.
Home, girl?
Yes.
He tucked a straggly, still damp lock of hair behind her tiny ear.
Wolf?
Her mouth trembled. The question was so big and complex. Yet she asked it all with that one word.
The wolf is okay, too.
She shook her head, and suddenly she appeared too old for her face, too knowing.
No. Trap. Bad.
He needs to be free, Max said, understanding her easily.
Like birds.
You know about trapped, don't you?
He stared down into her small, heart-shaped face. As much as he wanted to look away, needed to look away, he couldn't. She made him remember too many moments that had passed. The surprising thing was, they were good memories, some of them. From a time when he'd been able to stand still. A time when holding a child had made him laugh instead of cry.
Read, girl?
She pointed to a book on the coffee table. It was already open to a page. He picked it up. She immediately resettled herself so that she was positioned closely beside him. He looped one arm around her and opened the book between them. She pointed to the top of the page, very certain where she'd left off. He began to read. "Real isn't how you are made," said the skin horse. "It's a thing that happens to you. When a child loves you for a long, long time, not just to play with, but really loves you, then you become real." Max's voice broke on that.
"Read to me, Daddy."
He felt Alice's hand on his cheek, comforting him. Only then did he realize that he was crying.
"Ouch," she said.
He looked down at her, trying to remember the last time he'd let himself cry.
"All better?"
He tried to smile.
"All better."
Smiling at that, she snuggled up against him. He closed the book and started telling her another story, one he'd spent a long time trying to forget. But some words stayed with you. It felt good, saying it all to someone. Even if, by the time he got to the sad part, the part that made him want to cry again, she was fast asleep. 22. "The DNA is conclusive?" Julia asked. In the quiet of the car, her voice sounded louder than she would have liked. Because of the snow and the falling night, it felt as if they were cocooned in some strange spaceship. "I'm no expert," Ellie said, "but the lab report indicated certainty. And he knew about the birthmark. I have a call into the FBI. We'll know more in the morning, but..."
"What's her real name?"
"Brittany."
"Brittany."
Julia tested out the name, trying to make a match in her mind. She thought that if she focused on little things like that, tasks, she wouldn't think of the big things. Alice, Brittany, wasn't her daughter. She never had been. All along, the A answer had been this moment, Alice's reunification with her real family. It didn't matter that she had made a fatal mistake and fallen in love with the child. What mattered was Alice. That was the ledge Julia clung to. Why did it take him so long to get here? Ellie pulled into the parking slot, marked Chief of Police, and parked. Julia stared at the sign. The beam of the headlights seemed to set it aglow. At the same time, the falling snow obscured it. Everything about this night was conflicted, it seemed. "I understand you have a job to do, Elle. We both do. We let ourselves get too involved with her. I get it. But I'm a professional. Believe me when I tell you that I never lost sight of the risk I was taking, and I understand what's best for Alice." "That's a bunch of shit, but I know why you're saying it." Ellie turned to her. In the weird mixture of light and darkness, her face seemed older and full of shadows. "There's a problem."
"Tell me."
"Do you know who George Azel is?"
Julia frowned. It took her a moment to remember. "Oh, yeah, the guy who murdered his wife and baby daughter? Sure,
he's her father."
"No."
She shook her head. There must be some mistake. The Azel case had been as big a deal as the Scott Peterson trial. The millionaire murderer, they'd called him, referring to the dot-com empire he'd built. A circus of media attention had followed every confusing aspect of the process. The only certainty in the whole proceeding had been his guilt. "But he was convicted. He went to prison. How—"
"I'm not the one with the answers. He is."
Julia couldn't seem to move, couldn't think. Ellie touched her arm.
I can go in alone. Tell him I couldn't find you.
No. As Julia stepped out into the freezing night, she tried not to panic. Losing Alice to a loving family was something she would have made herself deal with. George Azell was something else.
Not to a murderer,
she muttered more than once on the long walk across the yard and up the stairs. All the way there, she tried to remember what facts she could about the trial. Mostly, she recalled that the jury had found him guilty. Cottonball snowflakes drifted lazily from the night sky, glowing in the pyramids of light from street lamps and windows. Inside the station, it was quiet. Julia blinked, letting her eyes adjust slowly to the light. The main room seemed larger than usual, but that was because she'd usually seen it during press conferences. Cal was at his desk, headphones on, and Peanut stood beside him. Both looked at Julia through worried eyes. Ellie's desk was empty. So was the chair in front of it.
He's in my office, Ellie said.
Oh. Ellie looked at Peanut, then at Cal.
You two stay out here.
Peanut's eyes filled with tears.
We don't want to hear it.
Cal nodded and reached for Peanut's hand. Ellie led Julia through the main room, past the twin jail cells with their open doors and empty bunks, to an open door. On it was a brass plaque that read, Chief. Ellie went in first. Almost immediately there were voices, hers a little too fast, his gravelly and low. Julia took a deep breath and followed her sister into the office. There were things to notice, of course, bookcases and a desk and family photos, but all Julia saw was George Azell. She might not have recognized him on the street or in a crowd, but she remembered him now. Tall, dark, and deadly. That was how the press had characterized him, and it was easy to see why. He stood well over 6 feet, with broad shoulders and narrow hips. His handsome face was all sharp angles and deep hollows and bruise-like shadows, the kind of face that darkened easily into anger. Black hair, threaded with gray, hung almost to his shoulders. His was the kind of face that launched a woman's dreams, although he looked worn.
You're the doctor, he said.
There was an accent in that voice, an elongation of syllables that made her think of New Orleans, of hot, decadent places and conversations that went on long into the night.
I want to thank you for everything you've done for my little girl. How is she?
Julia moved forward quickly, almost jerkily, and held out her hand. His handshake was firm, maybe even a little more than that.
And you're the murderer, she said, drawing her hand back. She had a sudden urge to wash the feel of him away. A murder one conviction, if I remember correctly.
His smile faded. He reached into his back pocket, pulled out an envelope, and tossed it on Ellie's desk.
To make an extremely long story short, the Court of Appeals reversed the trial court's denial of a motion to dismiss. It was a sufficiency of evidence thing. The Supreme Court agreed. I was released last week.
On a technicality.
If you consider innocence a technicality, I came home one day and my family was gone.
His voice cracked.
I never knew what happened to them. The cops decided I was a murderer, and that was it. They ignored any other evidence.
Julia had no answer to that. She tried desperately not to feel all this, but panic was stalking her.
She can't survive without me.
Look, Doc, I've been locked up for years. I have a big house on Lake Washington and enough money to hire the best care for her. So let's not beat around the bush. I need to show the world she's alive, so I want her now.
She stared at him, actually shocked by that. If you think I'm going to just hand Alice over to a murderer, you're crazy.
Who the hell is Alice?
That's what we named her. We didn't know who she was.
Well, you know now. She's my daughter, and I've come to take her home.
You're kidding, right? For all I know, you were behind the whole thing. You wouldn't be the first man to sacrifice a child to get rid of a wife. She saw a flash of something in his eyes. He closed the small distance between them.
I know who you are, too, Doc. I'm not the only one here with a shady past, am I? Do you really want a public fight?
Anywhere, she said, holding her ground. You don't scare me. He towered over her, whispered,
Tell Britt I'm on my way.
I won't let you have her. His breath was warm and soft against her temple.
We both know you can't stop me. Washington courts are pro-reunification of the family.
See you
in court.
As soon as he was gone, Julia sank onto a cold, hard chair. Her whole body was trembling. George Azell was right. The Washington State courts valued reunification of the family over almost everything else.
Do you want to talk about it?
Ellie said. Talking won't help.
Thinking will.
She took a deep breath. I need information on his case.
He gave me this.
Ellie pushed a stack of papers across the desk. Julia took the papers and tried to read. Her hands were trembling so badly that the letters shimmied on the white pages.
Jules?
Give me a minute, Julia said, hearing the desperate edge in her voice. It was taking every scrap of self-control she had to not start screaming or crying. And looking into her sister's sad eyes or hearing comforting words might push her into despair. Please. She focused on the documents. They represented the bare bones of the procedural history. The original motion to dismiss the case, made by Azell's attorney at the close of the state's case in chief. The denial of that motion. The appellate court's reversal. And the state Supreme Court's agreement with the reversal and dismissal. Of all of them, the one that mattered most to Julia was the original certification for determination of probable cause, which outlined the facts of the state's case. On April 13, 2002, at approximately 9:30 in the morning, George Azell placed a call to the King County Police Department to report that his wife, Zoe Azell, and his 2.5-year-old daughter, Brittany, were missing and had been missing for more than 24 hours. The Seattle Police Department responded immediately, sending officers to the Azell residence at 16402 Lakeside Drive on Mercer Island. A countywide, then statewide, search ensued. Community groups responded to the call and organized extensive search parties and midnight vigils. Investigations conducted throughout this period revealed that Mrs. Azell was having an affair at the time of her disappearance and had requested a divorce. Azell was also engaged in an affair with his personal assistant, Corinne Johns. Pursuant to their investigation, police learned the following facts. On or about November 2001, police responded to a domestic disturbance call at the Azell home. Officers observed bruising on Mrs. Azell and arrested Mr. Azell. This complaint was dismissed when Mrs. Azell refused to testify against her husband. On the evening of April 11, 2002, neighbor Stanley Seaman reported another disturbance at the Azell home, although he made no call to police. He stated to his wife that the Azells were at it again. Seaman noted the time of the fight as 11:15 p.m. At almost noon on Sunday, April 12, 2002, neighbor Stanley Seaman witnessed Azell loading a large trunk and a smaller, sack-like canvas duffel bag onto his seaplane. Azell asserts that he took off from Lake Washington in his seaplane with no passengers
on or about 1 o'clock on April 12. According to family witness testimony, he arrived at his sister's home on Shaw Island nearly 2 hours later. Experts confirmed to police that the ordinary flight time for that distance would be slightly less than an hour. Azell returned to his Lake Washington residence at 7 that same evening. A local flower delivery man, Mark Ulio, arrived at the Azell home at 4:45 on Sunday to deliver flowers which had been ordered by Azell via phone at 1 o'clock that day. At the time of their delivery, no one answered at the Azell house. Ulio reported seeing a Caucasian male in his mid-30s wearing a yellow rain slicker and a Batman baseball cap, getting into a white van that was parked across the street from the Azell residence. On Monday morning, Azell called several friends and family members to ask if they knew where his wife and daughter were. He told several witnesses that Zoe Azell had run off again. At 10:30 a.m., when Brittany did not show up at daycare and Zoe missed a meeting with her therapist, Azell called police and reported them missing. Upon identifying Azell as a suspect, police arrived at his home with a search warrant. On a rug in the living room, they found traces of blood. DNA analysis confirmed this blood as Brittany's. Additionally, hair samples found in the couple's bedroom, determined to be Mrs. Azell's, had the roots attached, indicating a struggle. A lamp on a dresser had a cracked base. Throughout the search period, officers repeatedly noted that George Azell was either inexplicably missing during the searches or seemingly unconcerned about his family's disappearance. Such behavior led police to consider Azell a suspect. Based on the information obtained, Sergeant Gerald Reeves placed Azell under arrest for the murder of his wife and daughter and advised him of his Miranda rights. State requests that no bail be granted in this case. This was a brutal and carefully planned and executed crime. Azell's considerable personal wealth, in addition to his pilot's license, makes him a serious flight risk. Under penalty of perjury, under the laws of the state of Washington, I certify that the foregoing is true and correct.
It was signed by the detective and dated. When she finished, she sighed and set the papers back on the desk. Footsteps thundered in the hallway. Peanut and Cal fought to get through the door. Peanut was first.
Well?
He's a scum, Julia said, an adulterer, and almost certainly a wife-beater. But according to the courts, he's not a murderer. He can't be retried for it, either. Double jeopardy. She looked at the worried faces around her. He's also her father. The DNA is conclusive on that. Washington State courts.
I don't give a shit about state law, Peanut said, looking down at Julia. What do we do to protect her?
We need a plan, Cal said. I'd stand in front of a bus for her, Julia said, and at that she felt herself go calm. The trembling in her hands stopped. I'd stand in front of a bus for her. It was true. Time to step into traffic, she said. And though she couldn't force a smile, couldn't in fact imagine ever smiling again, she was okay. She wouldn't think about what if. That would destroy her. She'd think only about Alice and how to protect her. Hire a detective, she said to Ellie. Go through Azell's records back to second grade. Somewhere, sometime, this son of a bitch hit someone or sold drugs or drove drunk. Find it. We don't have to prove he's a murderer, just an unfit parent. It was just past 5 o'clock when they got home, but it felt like the middle of the night. Clouds darkened the sky. An inch of snow frosted everything. The lawn, the roof, the porch railing. The house seemed to glow amidst all that whiteness. Ellie parked close to the house. Neither of them made a move to get out of the car.
I'm not going to tell her, Julia finally said, staring straight ahead. Ellie sighed.
How will you ever tell her? She hates it when you leave to make breakfast.
Julia couldn't go there, not to the imagining it place.
No leave girl, Julie.
She opened the car door and stepped out into the falling snow, barely feeling the cold. She walked up the steps, going from snow to wet wood, and opened the front door. The light and warmth hit her first. Then she saw Alice, curled up in Max's lap. At Julia's entrance, she looked up and grinned.
Julie!
She squealed, sliding out of Max's arms and running for Julia. She picked the little girl up, held her tightly. Hey, little one. She tried to smile. Hopefully it didn't look as brittle as it felt. Alice frowned up at her.
Sad?
Happy to be home, Julia said. Relief shone in Alice's eyes. She hugged Julia again and kissed her neck. Ellie came up behind them and smoothed Alice's hair.
Hey, girly girl.
Hi, Lily,
she said in a muffled, happy voice. Max was standing now. Firelight backlit him. The brightness made his face appear shadowed. Julia, he said. There was no mistaking the concern in his voice. It almost undid her. She sidestepped his touch, trying to make it look like an accident, but she saw that he wasn't fooled. Of course he wasn't. She didn't know much about Max, but she knew this. He recognized heartache, understood its taste and feel and texture. And he saw it now on her face. There was no way for her to hide it, not with Alice in her arms and George Azel's envelope in her coat pocket. If Max touched her now, she'd cry, and she didn't want that. God knew she would need strength for what was to come. He wants her back. The sad understanding in Max's eyes was almost more than she could bear. He moved slowly toward her. For a second, she thought he was going to kiss her. Instead, he said, I'll wait up for you. But it doesn't matter when. Come over when you can. You'll need me. She couldn't deny that. I'll wait up for you, he said again. This time he didn't wait for a response. He said goodbye to each of them and left. Silence swept in behind him.
Max, bye-bye, Alice said. No Julie leave?
Julie swallowed hard, feeling the sting of tears. She clung fiercely to Alice. I won't leave you, Alice, she said, praying it would be true. For the rest of the evening, Julia moved in a fog. Alice seemed to sense that something was wrong. She shadowed Julia even more closely than usual. By 9 o'clock, they were both exhausted. Julia gave the little girl a bath, braided her hair, and tucked her into bed. Snuggling in close on the narrow mattress, she tried to read a bedtime story, but the words kept blurring before her eyes.
Julie sad,
Alice said repeatedly, her small face scrunched into a frown. I'm fine, Julia said, closing the book and kissing the girl goodnight. I love you, she whispered against the soft, baby-scented cheek.
Stay,
Alice murmured, her eyes heavy. No, it's nighttime. Alice sleeps now. Alice nodded and popped her thumb in her mouth. Julia stared down at the girl.
My girl.
An ache blossomed in her chest. She turned away from the bed and went downstairs. Ellie sat at the kitchen table, reading through a stack of papers. The dogs lay on the floor beside her, uncharacteristically docile. The court said, Julia lifted a hand as if to ward off a blow. I can't talk about it right now. I need some time. Will you watch her?
Of course.
Julia went to the kitchen, grabbed the car keys and her purse. Every step seemed to jostle her bones. It felt as if she were held together with old Scotch tape. Goodbye. I'll be back soon. Outside, she drew in a deep, shaky breath. The night smelled of wet wood and new snow and the coming night. It wasn't until she was almost to the car that she realized she'd forgotten her coat. Freezing, she drove to Max's house. The heat came on just as she turned into his driveway. By the time she crossed the white yard and reached the porch steps, he was there, on the deck, waiting for her. Pale light spilled through an open window and cast him in a beautiful golden glow. She felt a powerful jolt at the sight of him. It came from somewhere deep inside of her, past muscle and bone, a place that was normally still. Coming home. That was how it felt. She climbed the steps toward him. He started to say something else, but she didn't want to hear his words, his voice, his questions. They would be concrete somehow, too heavy. She couldn't carry any more weight right now. She touched a finger to his lips. "Take me to bed, Max." He stared down at her, and for a moment, just that, she saw the man behind the smile, the man who knew a thing or two about loss.
"Are you sure?"
"You're wasting time. Alice," her voice broke this time, she had to force a smile, "might have a nightmare. I can't be gone long." He swept her into his arms and carried her up the stairs. She clung to him, her face buried in the crook of his neck. Seconds later, they were in his room. She slid out of his arms and took a step backward. Though distance was the last thing she wanted right now, she felt awkward, undone somehow. She unbuttoned her shirt, let it fall to the floor. Her bra followed. They stood there, separated by inches and yet worlds apart, undressing. Finally, both naked, they looked at each other. When he reached for her, she said nothing, barely even breathed. He circled his hand around the back of her neck and pulled her to him. Off balance, she stumbled a bit, fell into his chest. He kissed her slowly, with a gentleness that was both surprising and short-lived. She reached up for him, coiled her arms around him, stroking his skin, wanting him closer, closer. It flashed through her mind to push him away, to change her mind, say, "Stop, I was wrong, you'll break my heart." But her fear lasted no longer than an instant. Passion twisted it into something else. They moved to the bed. In a distant part of her mind, she saw that he was pushing his clothes aside, making a bower of rumpled white sheeting for their bodies. And then she was on the bed with him, beneath him, her hands desperate against his bare, hot skin. She was breathing so hard and fast she felt dizzy. His name slipped from her mouth to his. Neither one of them heard it. His hands pushed past her defenses, drove her down, past pleasure and into a kind of pain and back to pleasure again. As if from far away, she heard him rip open a condom package. Then her hands were on him, stroking it into place. He groaned and covered her body with his, moving against her until she couldn't think of anything, could only feel. When he entered her, with a thrust that went straight to the core of her, she cried out, terrified for a moment that she'd lost herself in all this need. When it was over, he held her close and kissed her again. It was long and slow and gentle, and it made her want to cry. "You're a good man, Max Saracen," she said throatily.
"I used to be."
She drew back just enough to look at him. In the pale light from a single lamp, she saw now what she'd refused to admit before, even to herself. She'd been lost from the moment she saw him, certainly from their first kiss. She hadn't nearly stepped into love. She'd tumbled headlong, like her beloved Alice, down the rabbit hole, to a place where nothing made sense. It didn't matter now whether he loved her back. What mattered was the love itself. This feeling of connecting with another heart. She could see, too, that he was worried. They'd come to a place that neither had quite expected, and there was no way to know how it would end. In the past, hell, yesterday, that would have frightened her. She'd learned a lot today. "Yesterday, I was worried about a lot of things. Today, I know what matters."
"Alice."
"Yes," she said softly.
and you.
Max lay beside her, holding her naked body close, and stared up at the ceiling. It had been a long time since he'd felt this way. He wanted to spend the night with Julia, to wake up beside her, to kiss her good morning, and talk about whatever came to mind. In ordinary times, that might have been possible. These were far from ordinary times. A part of her was breaking apart right now. She was holding herself together by sheer force of will. He rolled onto his side and looked down at her.
"You're so beautiful," he said, tracing her full lower lip with his finger.
"You too," she said with a smile. Her nose brushed his chin. When she smiled, her pale green eyes made him think of misty rainforest mornings, cool and deep and somehow magical.
"You're turning me into a romantic," he said.
"Then you already were one."
He smiled at that. "You shrinks always know what to say, don't you?"
She stared at him a long time before she answered. "Don't lie to me, Max. That's all I ask, okay? Don't pretend to feel something if you don't."
"I've never pretended with you, Julia."
"Then tell me something real."
"Like?"
She glanced over at the bureau along the wall. There were several framed pictures displayed, images from his life before. "Like about your marriage?"
"Her name was Susan O'Connell. We met in college. I loved her from the first moment I saw her."
"Until?"
He looked away for a second, then realized it was useless. Her keen eyes saw everything. Certainly he couldn't hide this pain by looking away. "Believe me, now isn't the right time for this conversation."
"Will there be a time for it?"
"Yes," he said softly. She kissed him gently, then drew back.
"I better go. Alice has trouble sleeping. She'll panic if she wakes and I'm gone."
As she said the girl's name, her voice wavered. "The courts will see your best for her."
"The courts," she said with a heavy sigh.
"You don't believe they'll do the right thing?"
"The truth is, I can't think about all that right now. If I do, I'll fall apart. For now, I'm going to focus on proving that he's an unfit parent, one step at a time."
"You'll need me."
The smile she gave him was slow and steady. It released something in his chest, made breathing easier somehow. "I certainly will." The night passed for Ellie in a river of black dreams and frightening images. When she woke, at dawn, she was edgy and nervous. The first thing she did was pull out the file. Already she'd read the words so often she'd almost memorized them. In the last 24 hours, she'd personally spoken to every single police officer who'd worked the Azell case. In addition, she'd spent nearly an hour on the phone with the best private detective in King County. Every person she spoke to, and every report she read, said the same thing. He was guilty. And the state hadn't proved it. Ellie paced the living room. The dogs followed her everywhere, running into her every time she turned. They were upset by her energy. It was on her shoulders to prove that Azell was a bad guy, an unfit parent. But so far, all she could find was a layer of innuendo, a fog of accusation. He was an adulterer. That was a fact. The only one she'd been able to nail down. Neighbors thought he hit his wife. Jurors believed he'd killed her, but on the basis of nothing concrete. And the media, every journalist she'd spoken to was certain he'd done it. "Guilty son of a bitch," was the label most often used to describe him. But not one story had uncovered previous bad acts. No drug charges, no DUI, not even a drunken disorderly. With a curse, she grabbed her files and left the house. She drove straight to the Raindrop. The diner was the only place open this early in the morning. As usual, it was full of loggers and fishermen and mill workers having breakfast before work. She stopped and talked to people in every booth as she made her way to the cash register. Rosie Chikowski was behind the hostess desk, smoking a cigarette. Blue smoke spiraled upward, joined with the hazy cloud that was always there.
"Hey, Ellie, you're in early,"
she said, pulling the cigarette from her mouth and stabbing it out in the ashtray. Patrons had been smoking in the raindrop for 50 years. No state law was going to change that. "I need some caffeine," Rosie laughed.
"You got it. How about one of Barb's Marionberry muffins to go with it?"
"Thanks. Only one, though. Shoot me if I try to order another."
"Flesh wound or kill ya?"
"Kill me." Laughing, Ellie turned around, heading back for a booth in the empty non-smoking section of the diner. It was a moment before she saw him. He sat sprawled across the burgundy vinyl booth, an empty coffee cup in front of him. He saw her and nodded. Ellie walked over to him. "Mr. Azell," she said.
"Hello, Chief Barton."
He did not look pleased to see her. His gaze flicked over the heavy manila folder she carried. "Can I join you? I have some questions to ask you." He sighed.
"Of course you do."
She sidled into the booth across from him. She looked at him, trying to really see him, but all she saw were tired eyes and deep frown lines. As she was marshaling her thoughts into a question, he said,
3 years.
3 years what? Leaning toward her, he looked deeply into her eyes.
"I was in prison for a crime I didn't commit. Hell, I didn't even know about it. I thought Zoe had left me for one of her lovers and taken our kid."
The intensity in his eyes was unnerving.
"Imagine how it would feel to be convicted of something terrible, horrific, and put in a cage to rot. And why? Because you made bad choices and let passion rule your life. So I had affairs. So I lied to my wife and family about that. So I sent her flowers after a knockdown, drag-out fight. It doesn't make me a killer."
The jury,
he said with contempt. "They couldn't see past my life. Every newspaper and TV station called me guilty within 5 minutes. No one even looked for Zoe and Britt. 2 eyewitnesses saw a strange van on my street the day my family went missing, and no one cared. The police didn't even bother to search for a white guy in a yellow slicker and Batman baseball cap who drove a grayish Chevy van. When I offered money for information, they compared me to OJ. For the last month, I've been waiting every day for the DNA analysis that would give my daughter back to me. I had to get a court order to compare her DNA to the blood found at the scene. And when I get it, I race up here, only to find that your sister is going to fight me for custody."
Rosie showed up at the table.
"Here's your coffee and muffin, Ellie. I put them on your tab,"
she grinned,
"along with a healthy tip."
When Rosie left, Azell leaned across the table.
"Do you believe me?"
She heard a crack in his voice, an uncertainty that bothered her. "You want me to see an innocent man," she said slowly, watching him.
"I am innocent. It'll be easier on all of us if you believe that."
"It would certainly be easier on you."
"How is she? Can you at least tell me that? Does she still suck her thumb? Does she..."
Ellie stood up quickly, needing distance between them. She didn't want to hear what he knew about their girl. "Alice needs Julia. Can you understand that?"
"There is no Alice," he said.
Ellie walked away, not daring to look back. She was almost to the door when she heard him call out to her.
"You tell your sister I'm coming, Chief Barton.
I won't lose my daughter twice.
The next 48 hours unfolded in a kind of faded slow motion. The snow stopped falling. In its wake, the world was sparkling and white. Julia spent every hour working. During the day, she was with Alice, teaching her new words, taking her outside to make snow angels in the backyard. Several times during the day, Alice asked about her wolf and pointed to the car. Julia gently turned her attention back to whatever they were doing. If Alice wondered why she kept kissing her cheek or holding her hand, she showed no sign of it. But it was the nighttime hours that mattered most right now. She and Ellie and Peanut and Cal and the private detective worked all night long, poring through police reports and newspaper accounts and archived videotape. After a long shift at the hospital, Max showed up to help. They read or watched everything they could find on George Azel. By Monday morning, when the meetings were over, they knew every fact of his life. And none of it would help them.
Read, girl?
Julia drew her thoughts back in and glanced at the clock. It was nearly 2 o'clock. No reading now, she said softly. Cal is bringing Sarah over to play with you. Do you remember Sarah? Alice frowned.
Julie stay?
Such an ordinary question. Not right now, honey. I'll be back, though. Alice smiled at that.
Julie back.
Julia dropped to her knees. Before she could figure out what exactly to say, the front door opened. Ellie, Cal, and Sarah walked into the house. No one bothered to say anything. Sarah showed Alice a pair of Barbie dolls. Alice didn't respond, but she couldn't look away from the dolls. After a few moments, the girls wandered into the living room, where they played separately, side by side. Alice still didn't know how to interact with other children, but Sarah didn't seem to mind. Ellie touched Julia's arm. You ready? Julia forced a smile and reached down for her briefcase. On the way out, she stopped to talk to Cal. She meant to say, when Alice feels comfortable, she'll talk to Sarah. But when she opened her mouth, nothing came out. Good luck, he said softly, squeezing her arm for comfort. Nodding, she followed Ellie out to the cruiser. In a silence broken only by the thump-thump of the windshield wipers, they drove to the county courthouse. It was a tall, gray stone building set on a hill above the harbor. The wild blue Pacific made a stunning backdrop. Today, the gray sky blurred the horizon, made everything appear watery and indistinct. Family court was on the main floor, at the very end of a hallway. Of all the courts Julia had once frequented, family was her least favorite. Here, hearts were broken every day. Julia paused, straightening her navy suit. Then she opened the door and went inside. Her high heels clicked on the marble floor. Ellie matched her step for step, looking ultra-confident in her gold-starred uniform. They passed Max and Peanut, who were seated together in the back row of the gallery. George Azel was already seated in the front of the courtroom with an attorney beside him. He saw them and rose from his seat, moving toward them. He wore a charcoal gray suit and a crisp white shirt. His hair had been tamed into a smooth ponytail.
Dr. Cates, Chief Barton.
Mr. Azel, Ellie said. Behind them, the courtroom doors banged open. Julia's attorney, John MacDonald, bustled in, carrying a worn leatherette briefcase. He looked tired, which was hardly surprising, given that they'd all been up until 4 o'clock that morning, looking for anything to use against Azel.
Sorry I'm late.
George looked at the opposing counsel, no doubt noting John's brown corduroy suit and pilled green shirt.
I'm George Azel, he said, reaching for the man's hand.
Oh, hello,
John said, then herded Julia and Ellie to their desk. The judge entered the courtroom and took her seat. From there, she stared down at all of them. Without preamble, she began. "I've read your motion, Mr. Azell. As you know, Dr. Cates has been temporary foster parent for your daughter for nearly 4 months, and had recently begun adoption proceedings."
"That was before, Your Honor, when the child's identity was unknown," his attorney said.
"I'm well aware of the time sequence, and I understand the procedural history of this case. The question for this court is placement of the minor child. Obviously, public policy favors the reunification of biological families whenever possible, but these are far from ordinary family circumstances."
"Mr. Azell has a history of domestic violence, Your Honor," John said.
"Objection!"
Azell's attorney was on his feet again. "Sit down, counsel. I know he's never been formally charged with that." The judge took off her reading glasses and set them on her desk, then looked at Julia. "The white elephant in this courtroom is you, Dr. Cates. You're hardly the average foster parent seeking permanent custody. You're one of the preeminent child psychiatrists in this country."
"I'm not here in that capacity, Your Honor."
"I'm aware of that, Doctor. It would represent a conflict of interest. You're here because you won't withdraw your petition for adoption." John started to stand up. Julia stopped him with a touch. No one could plead for Alice better than she could. She looked up at the judge, said, "In any other instance, Your Honor, I would have withdrawn if a family member had come forward. But I've read the records in this case, and I'm deeply concerned for the child's safety. The mother's body has never been found, and there's no finding of not guilty on the record. Mr. Azell claims to be innocent, but in my experience, most guilty people do. I just want what's best for this poor child who has already suffered so much. As you can see from my report, she's an extremely traumatized child. Until recently, she was completely mute. I'm making progress with her because she trusts me. To remove her from my care would cause her irreparable harm."
"Come on, Your Honor," Azell's attorney said. "She's a psychiatrist. My client can afford to replace her. The truth is, my client has already suffered a tremendous loss of time with his daughter. Justice demands that he be given immediate custody."
The judge put her glasses back on and looked at them all. "I'm going to take this under advisement. I'll appoint a guardian ad litem to assess the child's special needs and current condition, and let you know when I've reached a decision. Until then, the child will remain..."